Walter Garver.
And I am Heather Gring. Check, check, check. Okay, that's pretty good. Which is very nice. Cool. So this is the Living Legacy Project, normally at the Birchfield Penny Art Center, but today I am at the home of Walter Garver.
Studio.
Studio. Today I am at the studio of Walter Garver, or how would it be pronounced?
Oh, you want the German?
Yes, I was thinking that.
Garver.
Garver. Walter Garver before Ellis Island, Walter Garver now. And it is April 13th, 2016. And Walter, thank you so much for letting me come to your studio today.
You're very welcome.
So, and also just let me say that if I ever say anything that you're like, oh, don't include that in the interview, or if you say anything that you're like, don't include that in the final product, just say that, and then whoever edits this will edit that part out.
Very good.
Okay. So, Walter, you know, you've had a long and illustrious career here in Western New York and beyond, but if we can look back to your roots, when you were a young man, what inspired you to want to be an artist?
It's probably a lot of things. First of all, my father was interested in art, but of course he could not become an artist because he had a family to support.
Mm-hmm.
So I was never discouraged to not be interested in art by my folks. They said, go ahead. And I can remember in the fifth or sixth grade in Medina, New York, when I was fascinated by the work of Walt Disney.
Mm.
I thought he was very creative in the things that he was doing. They were brand new. And I thought that, boy, I'd like to do some of that stuff. And so I continued my studies of art in school, in junior high and senior high. And when I graduated, I went on to the Albright Art School here in Buffalo and started to study art there. At the time, I thought, gee, I'd like to become an illustrator, because then magazines like Collier's and Saturday Evening Post were doing the illustrators that were doing some really fantastic work.
Mm-hmm.
And many of their paintings today are collector's items. So that's sort of dissipated because of, the magazines just, interest in magazines just dried up.
Mm-hmm.
There are still magazines, of course, but no longer things like Collier's or the Saturday Evening Post. And so where to go? So I started painting, and I was one of the, how shall I put this? There was, you probably don't remember, but every spring, the Albright, now the Albright Knox, had their Western New York show.
Yes.
And I'm the only artist to win first prize in the show twice in a row.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was encouraging.
Mm-hmm. Very encouraging.
And so I started sending around, exhibiting in various shows, in won major prizes in New York, places like New York,
mm-hmm.
the Ottoman Artists Show, Design Academy Show, and things like that. And of course, I was helped along the way by studying with Mr. Birchfield, and of course, he had financial difficulties, as you know. So, but that didn't discourage me. I recall he, as you know, well, going even back, after we moved from Medina to Batavia,
mm-hmm.
and I was taking art classes in Batavia High School, and the art teacher, who was very encouraging, invited Mr. Birchfield to come out and demonstrate. And that was rather inspiring. He's a very nice man, but a very sad man, because at the time he was having, as I said, financial difficulties.
About what year was that?
Oh, that would be back in the 1940s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, you just met my wife. she was a very good friend of Martha. They also both went to Albright.
Really? Oh, that's fantastic.
So from there, I went on to exhibit, as I just said, around the country,
mm-hmm.
and in Buffalo. And I started to, I'm getting ahead of myself. I wasn't particularly influenced by Mr. Birchfield's style, because my major influences were Edward Hopper.
Mm-hmm.
He said that all he wanted to do was paint light, and many of my paintings, that was my primary interest. And as far as technique was concerned, Andrew Wyeth, because he was a fantastic realist. But if you look close, if you really consider his work, he's not a complete realistic. He's more, there's an awful lot of fantasy in his work. So those two, plus a few other artists, influenced me a great deal, and I continued to paint. And fortunately, recognized by being included in such things as Who's Who in American Art, etc.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned, so can we talk a little bit more about the Albright Art School and your time there? What was it like being a student at the Albright Art School?
One of a crowd.
Yeah? How big were the classes?
I can't remember the exact amount.
Sure, but I mean, are we talking like 20 people, 40 people?
No, not that many. 20 each class had about 20.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the professors you studied with there?
Phil Elliott.
Okay.
Virginia Cuthbert.
Yeah.
And Eddie Casper. He was a primary influence there. Nobody probably remembers him, but he was a real disciplinarian.
Mm.
Not a disciplinarian, but his attitude was, art is a damn difficult profession, and you'd better be prepared for it.
Yeah.
And he didn't, for example, one time I didn't get a homework assignment done, and he tossed me out of class.
Really? Wow. Well, now, you know, with the lens that you have now, having spent decades as an artist and building your career, do you think that that tactic was called for or uncalled for?
Called for.
Uh-huh.
And it was good for me.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I got to know people like Charlie Penny, who is a very fine man. I liked him a lot. I would frequently visit him in his, I think it was... the Bewley building, where he had the entire floor.
Yes.
And he'd show me his things in his collection. Good grief, what a place.
What a place.
So much stuff.
That's really what it comes down to. And now, so much stuff. You know, everything from the Papua New Guinea collections to the Mr. Peanuts collections to certainly he owned a number of your works, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
He bought... several of my things,
mm-hmm. works
which
that
which you have.
Yes, works that we now have in the collection of the Birchfield Penny Art Center.
What
was he like? Like, as a person, what was he like?
Very outgoing.
Yeah.
And Jane and I would go out to, he would invite us out to his cottage on Lake Ontario, mm-hmm. and have a little lunch and everything. He was really a very, very nice man.
He seems like he was... Just like in half of the pictures I've seen of him, his mouth is always open. He's got like what I imagine, I've never heard him laugh, but he looks like he has this big laugh.
Oh, he was, as I said, very outgoing.
Yeah, that's wonderful. We, at the Birchfield Penny Art Center, just last Friday, we opened a show called The Birthday Party, a celebration, a community of artists. And it's all around, centering around Virginia Cuthbert's painting, The Birthday Party, which is a backyard garden scene with all local painters who are attending this birthday party.
I think I know the work.
Yes. But so it's really made me think about Virginia Cuthbert and Phil Elliott in these ways. Can you speak a little bit about what they were like at all?
Well, I don't remember Virginia very well. She was an offhand teacher.
Mm-hmm.
didn't say much, but Phil was a more of a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me one time, get out of Buffalo Garver.
Wow.
If you want to succeed.
Yeah. Well, and that in some ways, that's a insight, a piece of advice that I think artists even today come up against, you know, and admittedly though, Buffalo is a very different place at that time, you know, when you got that advice. And I think that it's sometimes even more true, but I do think that the speed of travel in some ways makes it so some artists can afford to live here and exhibit beyond, you know. But, well, did you take his advice? You're here, still here in the region.
Yeah. I didn't take his advice because I just couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
I did go to New York City, and there are a couple of dealers that handle my work. One of them is Simeon Olschwang on Madison Avenue in the Hall of Art. And can't remember the other name, but they did well for me, so I really didn't need to move
mm-hmm.
out of Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. I think some artists still feel the same way.
This keeps popping into my mind. Well, I put on a one-man show at the Hall of Art, and while I was hanging, Jane and I were down there hanging the paintings. And this fellow walked in. You probably, have you ever seen Hawaii Five-0 on TV?
Yes, I have.
You know the actor Steve McGarrett, who plays a part of Steve McGarrett?
Yes.
Before him, there was another actor. There was the previous version of Hawaii Five-0.
Uh-huh.
And he walked in.
Just walked into the gallery.
To look at my work.
Oh, that's so New York. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. You're hanging a show and just any famous actor can walk in and, well, did he buy anything?
No, but he looked around and smiled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's so funny. Yeah. Well, yeah, what a illustrious thing to be included in, just in the, you know, that environment in New York at that era. That's wonderful. Sometimes it takes me a moment to think of, like, what sort of questions I'd like to ask next and
okay.
things like that. And how long did you have representation in New York? Are there still galleries that represent you?
Oh, no,
you?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Simeon died.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, after a while, he sold several things for good prices, as high as $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he went out of business, too.
Mm-hmm.
Gallery business comes and goes. As
Absolutely.
You well know.
Yeah. So, and it's an ever-shifting goalpost, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's always changing. Well, we spoke about where you went to school, and you had already mentioned some of your important influences as an artist. But are there any other influences, either, you know, people you studied with or artists you look at or anyone else you'd like to mention as an influence?
Well, as I go along, I brush against various influences. For example, this painting right here, it's not finished. It's called Wood Nymph. And Jim Hall, who's the curator of Oxford Gallery in Rochester, incidentally, my other agent is Vern Stein in Williamsville.
Yes.
Very good man. How shall I put it? I pick up these influences as I go along, and right now I'm sort of interested in the work of Arthur Rackham.
Yes!
You know?
Oh, I love Arthur Rackham's work, yes.
Oh, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I'm thinking of, this painting is not finished. And incidentally, I've gone from working mostly with oils to mixed media.
Mm-hmm.
This painting or work, for example, is a combination of acrylic, pastel, pure watercolor, colored pencil, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
I've included it.
But you're still making exceptional work.
Thank you.
It's really exciting to see. You know, I know that, you know, and so when, not to bring it, so my relationship with Charles Birchfield, or Charlie as I call him, is he is one of my dearest friends who has been dead since before I was born. But I work so closely with his archives, with his materials, reading his journals, looking at his thoughts from any day. And so it, very much so in his journals, he writes about how severe some of his health issues were, you know, that affected that affected his ability to paint.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he suffered from lumbago, which was something that would just keep him in bed for days, you know, at various points. There's actually a painting that is currently included in a Birchfield exhibition that I've curated that's up right now, and it's about an unfinished work called The Walnut Bed, which is a very unusual piece for him. It's an interior scene, it's a bedroom, there are two sleeping bodies in a bed, but he writes about it in his journals. He kept coming back to this idea for decades, and he writes one day, he says, I went back to work on the walnut bed, and I have not worked with such vigor and assurance in years, you know, and he was just like feeling so good.
Good.
But then unfortunately the very next day he was struck by another bout of lumbago and was just holed up in bed for weeks, you know. And so it's very interesting to see how much that drive to create, you know, comes out at different points of people's lives.
It's a monkey on your back.
Yeah.
I have a number of students who went on, former students, who went on to pursue a career in art, careers in art. And they have the same attitude. It's a monkey on their back. They have to. It's a compulsion.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful compulsion. And what I really like about this piece here, this piece that Walter's working on called Wood Nymph, you mentioned?
Wood Nymph.
That's such a classical connotation, and certainly one that Rackham played with as well in these sort of very fantastical illustrative styles. But the woman you've depicted, she seems to be wearing sneakers. You know, she seems to be, in some ways, she seems to be very real.
Sandals.
She seems to be a very real person in some ways.
Well, it's not a finished painting. Yes. I have yet to include gossamer wings on her.
Oh, good. That'll certainly change the sort of conception of it, of the piece.
It's a work in progress.
Absolutely. And, well, I like where you're going with it, is what I'm trying to say. It both feels very approachable and very, very mystical. Absolutely. Rackham's work was also very influential to a artist who I worked closely with in Vancouver in British Columbia named Charles Van Sandwyk.
Don't know him.
I'll see if I can find some images of his work to mail you. Charles Van Sandwyk, he's still living. I got to interview him in a similar way. But he makes what seem like children's stories for adults.
Huh.
They're very much like he's very influenced by Beatrix Potter and...
Oh, yes, I know.
Mm-hmm. And in those ways, but they're moralizing stories, very loving for adults, not for children.
Beatrix Potter I've read her about her, not her work about herself.
Yes.
And she liked animals, but she, I think I recall one story about she raised pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And slaughtered them for the meat.
Yeah. And that's realism. That's reality, you know, in a lot of ways.
So I was a little disappointed.
Oh. Well, I think, quite honestly, I think so long as the pigs had a good life, in a lot of ways, like, that's what you can ask for. But she also, man, talk about an uphill battle, right? Like, she had to fight to get her works published, and
right,
first self-published.
Yes.
And then I believe she fell in love with her publisher's son, and they were engaged to get married, and he died right before they were supposed to get married.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's a little bit of knowledge dropping. Well, you know, we started talking about this unfinished work here, but let's segue into talking about your art and...
Oh.
What you create and why you create.
Yes. Well, previous to this Well, I've done a series of nudes, but female nudes, because again, I'm interested in the human body. It's a very beautiful, it can be a very beautiful thing.
Yes.
And up until just recently, I've done a long series on the Buffalo waterfront and the grain mills. Mm-hmm. They're a fantastic treasure, and anybody who wants to tear them down is like one someone who wants to destroy national monuments. I've been through there. I've been in them. Inside of one, what a monster!
So
it's indescribable. So I've done at least a dozen of those. And let's see. Well, I've done a few portraits, but that's going back a little bit. And I've done a lot of doors. You have the white door in your collection, which is one of my best.
It's one of my favorite works in our collection.
Why?
Because of the straightforward manner of how you approach it. It just seems like you can absolutely, it both seems very, very approachable and very distant. And your manner, your technique is certainly incredible. But it both looks like you could just open it at any point, and it looks like it'll never open.
Very good point. The reason I'm interested in doorways is just that. We go through life approaching doorways. Do we open the door or not?
Mm-hmm. And how would you apply that metaphor to your own life?
Oh, I really don't know. I've approached a lot of things I might have done but didn't.
Mm-hmm. But what about the things you have done? I mean, quite honestly, the decision to live your life as an artist is not what our society considers to be the safest choice. That's a big door that you did walk
through.
Well,
I just, as I said, I just became interested in art, and it's just propelled me. The monkey on my back.
Yeah. The monkey on your back, making your hand turn that knob, right?
Well, makes me want to express myself through art.
Yes, absolutely. And also through those metaphorical depictions of what all of us sort of go through in our lives, of the doorways. And sometimes it's not as easy as just, do you push it open or not? It's how much force are you going to use to get that door open, you know? Sometimes it takes a lot of force, but it'll budge. I'm just thinking about my life now. I'm thinking about some of the big leaps that I've taken. You know, I mentioned I went to school in Vancouver, but I had been living in Buffalo for years at that point.
Are you Canadian?
No, I'm not. I did my undergraduate. I grew up in Syracuse, New York.
Oh.
I did my undergraduate at Buffalo State in art history, and that's how I first got to know the Birchfield.
Oh, that there's another thing. I taught for from 1978 to 86 at Amherst Senior High School. And I taught basic art,
mm-hmm.
drawing, painting, photography, and art history.
So you did all of it.
And so I'm quite immersed in art history. Many interesting things about it. For example, I had to study religion because early art is mostly has religious subject matter, starting with the Egyptians.
Yeah.
So if you don't understand the religion of these behind these various styles, you're not really completing your knowledge of them.
Yes.
That went on right on up through. Well, let's see, the Rococo, and died out in the early 1800s. That's when we started to get the non-religious subject matter.
Yes, and talk about encompassing all of history in your studies, right? I mean, the relationship between history and art is so intertwined.
Right.
Can't pull it apart. Would you say that your time teaching art history and having to be a student of art history as well influenced your work?
Oh, I don't know, but I certainly enjoyed it, and I met a lot of great kids, many of them who went on to become artists.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, there's one by the name of a lady by the name of Coleman, who's having a show right now at Fox Run.
Oh, really? And where's that gallery?
Somewhere in the South Towns, I'm not sure.
That's something I really love about Western New York and about working at a museum that's so focused on the arts community in Western New York, is that the degrees of separation is like, you know, half. It's like half of a degree. The fact that, you know, you are an artist represented in our collection, but I'm able to make a phone call and come out to see you, you know, and learn about other people who have studied with you who are also exhibiting in the region. I just think that especially, you know, when I look at the contrast to, say, the Albright Knox right across the way, you know, they cannot call up just one of the artists in their collection and say, hey, can I come over in 2 weeks? You know, it's just, I love how much closer these degrees are to each other.
Well, I'm a little disappointed in the direction that the Albright has taken. That's why I support the Birchfield Penny. They are, well, they're really Western New York, whereas I think the Albright Knox has become sort of a, they want to become a sort of a museum of modern art.
Yes. And certainly though their roots are deep in the region. I think at this point their focus is quite beyond the region.
Right.
And I see that in a lot of different ways. And I also see that there's big, I'm proud that Buffalo is a big enough town to have both, you know, to have,
yeah.
But now, granted, you have such roots with the Albright Art School in those ways. Is there anything else you want to add?
No.
Okay, great. So we talked about some of the different series that you've worked in. We talked about your focus on different subject matters, such as the grain elevators, which I completely agree with you. They are one of my favorite parts of this region. And you, when you were painting them, were they still active?
Some of them, yes.
Yeah. And you know, the good news is I don't think they're going anywhere. Apparently, it is nearly impossible to demolish them.
Oh yes, that's one of the things that save them. They're,
yeah.
Those things are. You probably don't know, but there's a book out on it called "The Modern Pyramids," and try to destroy a pyramid.
Yes. Right. Just try. Is there anything else you'd like to say about different themes in your work which have emerged throughout your career?
Only that I really had two interests, writing and painting. And I was a contributing editor to the Artist Magazine and Watercolor Magic for 20 years. And wrote a number of articles about watercolorists and my painting and so on. And I've also written a historical novel called Children of the Forest.
Yes, I wanted you to speak on that a little bit more. We have a copy of it in the archives.
Let's put it this way. We have a reservation right down, about 10 miles from here,
mm-hmm.
in Akron, I guess in that area. And I was fascinated by it's an Iroquois nation there, which incidentally is not really, that's a French name.
Mm-hmm.
It's Haudenosaunee.
Wow.
It's what they're really called.
Haudenosaunee.
Or Haudenosaunee. So I spent 3 years researching this novel. And of course, the fact that Fort Niagara is right down the road here too. So the combination of what we're on back in the early 1700s around Fort Niagara and the Iroquois League was fascinating to me. So I went, as I said, for about 2 to 3 years researching all of this stuff, and I came up with a lot of fascinating things. One of the things that particularly impressed me was this, well, the Seneca people love to gamble. And they had a lot of games in which gambling took place. And one of them was called the Snow Snake.
The Snow Snake, I am aware of the Snow Snake, but go on and describe what it was.
Well, during the winter, they would drag a log through the snow and then pour water in the depression that it had created. And then these sort of javelin-like instruments, spears, with a snow snake, with a snake carved on the tip, would be thrown down these channels. And those who were able to throw it the furthest won. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's all kind of betting on who would throw the furthest.
Oh my gosh, you know, I never really thought about the gambling side to it, because years ago I used to work at the Buffalo Museum of Science as a gallery guide there, you know, walking around and talking to people about what they're looking at. And so in winter we would have, like, you know, we would have big events in winter where we would do snowshoeing and stuff like that. And one thing we would always do was to recreate the snow snake, but it was never really brought up that there was a gambling component to it. That's fascinating.
And of course, he's probably gone now, but I actually, at the reservation down here, visited a fellow who still made snow snakes.
Really?
He showed them to me.
Oh my gosh. And what was his name?
I don't remember.
You remember? Yeah. They must have been beautiful.
Yes, they were. A lot of craftsmanship.
Yes. When were you doing all that research?
Well, oh no, let's see.
We could always look at, I can always encourage people to look at when the book was released.
Yeah. That's been a disappointment to me, because I thought it was, people who have actually gotten a copy and have read it said they enjoyed it very much, but the sales were minuscule.
Mm-hmm. Was it self-published or was there a publisher?
Well, it's one of these self-publishing outfits.
Oh, you have a poster for it. Oh, Ex Libris. Now, did you do this illustration?
Yes. That's Mask Maker.
Yeah. And so, did you talk with the community about sort of, did you share any of this with the Iroquois nation or community and, like, get their thoughts about it?
Not really, but I've heard no complaints.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. That's often a very good sign. Well, good. Well, maybe we'll see. We only have one copy in the archives, so maybe if I handle it gently, I can read it on my lunch break some days, but I can't take it out of the archives.
Let's see. Just a minute. I'll be right back.
Okay. Well, to answer my question about when Children of the Forest was published, it was in 2009, and it is available through Amazon.com or...
oh, yes.
Right? Or BarnesandNoble.com or from ExLibris.com, I believe.
Interesting sidelight on that. When I was teaching at Amherst, they would occasionally have foreign students come in, and I had one from Italy and one from Japan. And the Japanese woman, who is now back in Japan and is a medical doctor, her name is Yoko Ishino. And this is, again, modern science amazes me. She actually called me and said that she'd like a copy of Children of the Forest, so I sent her one.
And she called you from Japan?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's wonderful. See, so it is getting some attention. So sometimes it's those little connections that.
Well.
I know. It's one book isn't anything.
I know about perhaps 4 or 6 people who have gotten copies, and they've all liked it very much.
I think the challenge is that, well, much like the art world, right? The literary world as well is this whole other avenue to try and break into.
Oh, everybody's writing a book.
I know. Everybody's making art and everybody's writing a book.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, I have to say, like, as I continue to talk with you today, I see similarities between you and Mr. Birchfield. You know, Birchfield wrote every day of his life. As a young man, he was, you know, I'm not trying to tell you anything you don't know, but maybe for our listeners, as a young man, he was very conflicted about whether or not to pursue being a writer or an artist.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He wanted to be a naturalist writer. He wanted to write about nature, but also write narratives. And there is a journal quote from a journal entry from when he was a young man where he says, you know, oh, and I'm paraphrasing completely, but he's weighing these two life paths. And he says, well, how in paint, you know, how visually could I represent the sound of a bird song? How could I do that, you know? And the answer is he figured out how to do that. He, you know, very much with the symbolic sort of
yes.
vibrancies within his works and that sort of magical quality to it. But he acknowledged at a very young age that you can do that in writing, you know, but it's much harder to do that in a painting.
Well, I certainly admire his paintings. It's just that I couldn't do that type of thing.
It's very different from the way you work, you know. And so you primarily worked throughout your career in oils, primarily?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, let's talk a little bit about that creative process of working in oils for you, and now that you're moving into more mixed media. What would you say are some of the sort of techniques that you used when you were working more primarily in oils? And then how are you sort of combining all these different elements today?
Well, the oils are all... I tried canvas, but I didn't like it. There's just a certain spring to the surface that is irritating. So I switched to Masonite. And this was back when Masonite was just becoming very popular. And I actually did some research on it because some were saying, well, Masonite is not good for painting because it's an unknown quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, will it last?
Right.
And so on. And so I said I did some research and actually wrote an article which was published that I got in touch with the Masonite people, and the stuff is fine.
Uh-huh.
It's very, very lasting. So I would use Masonite panels. I prefer an eighth of an inch to a quarter of an inch, because a quarter of an inch panel can be very, very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would put a gesso base on it,
mm-hmm.
and then using oil paints in layers, build up to get certain effects.
Mm-hmm.
I use all kinds of techniques, spatter brush,
mm-hmm.
which I learned from Wyeth. They all right had an exhibition of Andrew Wyeth's work years ago, and I went to see that and looked very closely at all the work, and he taught me, those paintings taught me a lot about technique. And then of course when the painting had dried sufficiently, I would varnish it.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, now you've got me thinking, I saw a very good show of Wyeth's work at the National Gallery in DC last year. And there's just something about the way he paints curtains, you know, and curtains in the breeze that
mm-hmm.
is just the most airy, sumptuous sort of quality that I've rarely seen elsewhere.
That reminds me also, at one time he was advertising for students.
Mm.
Oh, let's see, what is this place that they're...
At his museum?
No, where he was it in Pennsylvania where he had his studio?
Yes. Oh my gosh, we just did a collaboration with his museum.
Well, anyway,
I can't remember the name.
He advertised for a student that I wrote, and they sent me back. They sent me back material about it, but at the time it was very frustrating. I couldn't afford it.
Yeah, isn't that such a challenge? And you know, I'm sure that he was asking a certain amount because he had to pay his bills too. You know,
right.
Like, but it does seem to trickle down rather than up in those ways sometimes. He also Wyeth carried on correspondence with Martha Birchfield at various points. Yes. We have some letters in the archives from Andrew Wyeth to Martha. I believe it's Martha. Maybe it was Catherine.
Well, we have a couple of Martha's paintings. Mm-hmm. They look very much like her father's work.
When you first look at them, absolutely, you're like, oh, this is a little strange for Birchfield. And then you're like, oh, no, it's Martha. Yeah. And I certainly think they each have their different focus. And I think it was, maybe your wife sounds like she knew Martha, but I think it was very difficult for Martha and
Catherine.
Oh,
they were best buds.
Yeah. Really? I would love to actually come out and talk to her about Martha at some point.
Well, I don't think she remembers too much because that was so many years ago.
So many years ago. I know. We aren't very close with her son, David Richter, but when he comes into town, he will stop in, and he certainly, like, purchased a large collection of Birchfield memorabilia from him many years ago now. But he gave me some great insights into his grandfather, which is really cool. So we talked a little bit about, you know, your process with oil paint. What about what you're doing now with mixed media? How is that, has that been sort of a learning curve for you at various points? Are you applying your same skill sets just to different media?
Well, one of the things about oil is the slow drying time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with this mixed media, I can go right ahead without any impediment.
Mm-hmm. That must dramatically change sort of how deep you can get into it at one point. I'm thinking, like, with oil paint, and certainly I don't consider myself an artist, but with oil paint, it's like you do some stuff, you do some changes, some work on it, and then you have to put it aside, right? And then you have to pull yourself out of the sort of process while it dries. But do you find that this allows you to sort of complete works faster?
Right.
Okay.
At my age, that's a good thing.
Well, I think that is a very proactive strategy to life. Work with what you got.
And this is the same thing, mixed media.
I really enjoy this one. I was enjoying that one upstairs, these still lifes.
Well, that was a study for this.
Mm-hmm. They're beautiful still lifes. And they're shading along the table, and those lines there are just really beautiful.
And it's, as I said, it's frustrating. No, I have a studio full of unsold paintings. My agents have, they're almost all together in the studio and in the two galleries. There must be 30 or 40 unsold paintings. It's a little depressing.
The times are changing, and we were talking about this a little bit beforehand, how there's, before we were recording, how there's so much visual stimulus.
And another thing is, I've got Vern Stein has mentioned this several times. The damn Chinese, excuse the language, have factories where you can send them a request, some references or photographs, and ask them to do a painting. And they'll turn it out and send it back with a frame for $200 or $300.
And that is so depressing. Yep.
It is.
Yep.
How can you compete with that?
You can't. But also removes so much of the, you know, like, having interviewed a lot of artists at this point, I've interviewed about 50 artists now, and everybody approaches it from a different place, you know, but there is this sort of, like, purity of desire, you know, that goes with the life choice to be an artist. You're not trying to I mean, it'd be nice if you got rich. I'm sure that you would like to be more comfortable in those ways, but you know, you didn't
It's not so much the rich. I would just like people to buy my work because they appreciated it. They liked it.
Yes. Yes.
That's more the sales are important, but that's equally important.
Yeah. And I think that speaks to something that is on a deeper human level, you know, than commerce. And when somebody can co-opt that, like what happens when, and it is true, what's happening with the art market and perhaps with China or other unregulated countries, right, is happening with labor, too. It's been happening with the labor movement.
Yes.
Since the 70s. Well, since before that, but. You know, my thing is, and we kind of talked about this a little bit, I would love to be able to afford one of your works, you know, but it's with how depressed the economy here is in a lot of ways, there is a lot of, it's going to take me another 10 years to be able to be in a place where I'm stable enough to afford something of the quality of this, you know? But I wonder, have you heard, do you know A.J. Fries? Have you ever met him?
No.
He is a, he doesn't like the term photorealistic, but he is a realistic oil painter here in Buffalo. Does some really exciting works. But he and his wife have started a project that's called Collect Art. And so in some ways, what they're doing is they're getting people to sign up for subscriptions. And for a subscription, you will be sent, the subscriber is sent a work of art every few months. So you subscribe for a year, and then you can actually, you can choose the types of work you like, but they will send you works maybe by artists that you don't know based on what you have subscribed for. So it's a way to try and combat, it's not only works made in China, but it's also works from JCPenney's, you know, that are just non-art, wall art. How can you get more real local art into people's homes who want aesthetics, but maybe don't know how to navigate that? Suburban houses have a lot of walls. Yeah. But maybe what I'll do is I'm going to send you a little mail packet, and I'll include information about Collect Art. So we've spoken about a lot of different things, but I'd like to ask you about the things that you have done throughout your career to advance your career in the arts. You know, what are some of the ways in which you had to navigate it? And I'm asking this because a lot of times the people who listen to these interviews, I imagine as young artists who are emerging from school. And granted, you were establishing yourself at a very different time. But I do think that there's something we can learn there from learning about how artists have had to promote themselves and their work.
I really don't know how to answer that.
Well, let's see. Were you a member of different... Well, you
oh,
wrote,
yes.
Right?
I am still a member of the Buffalo Society of Artists.
Mm-hmm.
And a past president,
mm-hmm.
which was interesting. And I was, as I've said, a member of the American Academy of Design, Ottoman Artists. Those are New York City organizations. I worked with a lot of artists, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Networking.
Been associated with them.
Mm-hmm. Community building is the way I like to look at it, you know?
Yeah, that's good.
Yep. Wonderful. Well, I would, I'm going to skip the next few questions about some of your needs that the larger community can provide, because I don't think that's necessarily where you're at.
No.
But can I ask, I have a feeling that you're going to have a interesting answer for this. I want to ask what advice you might have for emerging artists.
Well, I think I've already covered that. Don't. It's with all of these, we are now in a different, completely different era. If you want to be creative and earn a living with it, you won't. Unless you are, well, there, as I've already expressed, if you do these fashionables or do a new style every year or something like that and have the right connections, but otherwise, why bother?
Well, the way I see it is, why bother trying to make it with that?
Yeah.
You know, but that same monkey that's on your back is on a lot of people's backs, and I think there are ways.
So, find outlets for your need to express yourself.
Yeah.
But don't depend on traditional ways of doing it, because they're no longer available.
Well, and I have to tell you that, I mean, that's not just true of the arts. That's true of just about everything. You know, my parents, my father worked for a company his whole life and retired, and actually was pushed into early retirement, but he retired. And in contrast, you know, I've come up in a workforce or a generation where I've been trained to only expect to work at a place for 2 to 5 years, you know? My hope is that with the Birchfield that it will be something that will have more longevity than that. But I've kind of always got, talk about doors, you know, I've always got my foot in and out of another door because, you know, we've been taught that the longevity of a career at one place doesn't exist anymore.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I will say, so I'm just trying to commiserate with you that that's a bigger boat than just painters. Yeah. Well, speaking of painters, I'd like to go off script a little bit, and I'd like to ask you more about Mr. Birchfield.
Well, I just had that encounter with him in Batavia,
mm-hmm.
and the summer school that I attended with him, that he was holding, teaching, because he needed the money. And I've visited his home and been in his studio. Is sort of a cottage out back, and we've had some discussion about art. I can't remember exactly what it was. That was so long ago.
Yes.
I just remember him occasionally mentioning why he painted the way he did. He particularly mentioned sunflowers because they looked so sad when they were dying.
Mm.
And that's why he, one of the reasons he painted them. And he talked a little bit about his work, but I can't remember his exact words.
That's okay. You know, I admit.
Oh, and the way he painted, there's something I just remembered. At the summer class. He demonstrated, did an actual demonstration of how I painted, and he showed his brushes, and he just didn't use regular brushes. He bought these very good brushes, and then he would cut them down so that they were there wasn't much left in the way of hair on them or bristles, because he liked to. The fact that he could more or less scrub the paintings.
It's so funny you mentioned that, because I was just giving a tour earlier today of this one piece, Spiders and Grasshoppers, that we have, and it's unfinished. But you can clearly see the scrub marks where the fiber of the paper has been destroyed, because he scrubbed out the grasshoppers so hard. But all those little paper pulps are still attached. And so it's kind of, that's a beautiful insight for me to know, like, what he was using to leave those marks as he's scrubbing things out or adding things in.
Good. And one other thing I just remembered, this was in Batavia. And as I said, this was in the 40s. And the war was on, and paper was very hard to get. So he'd have to find these scraps of paper. Well, not scraps, maybe.
Strips.
Strips, more like it, and paste them down, and he described how he did that.
His process for that, they wrote an article on that, I think in Art in America in 1942, about his process for that specifically. But I always wonder, and this is just my conjecture, but I wonder if he got the idea for that when he was working at the Burge Wallpaper Company.
Ah, yes. That's another... thing he would talk about. I don't remember exactly what he said, but yes, that's where he got that.
Really? I've always just kind of, I've just said, well, he worked with wallpaper, you used adhesive, you put it together, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Where, that is so fascinating. That's so fascinating. Wow, that just made my day. You have to understand that, like, Mr. Birchfield, as you call him, or Charlie, as I call him, because he signs his letters that way sometimes.
Oh.
He is someone I care very much about, who I never will meet. And I actually, and this is a little funny, but I have a tattoo on my hip that is an excerpt from one of his paintings.
Really?
And I know him from Dandelion Seed Heads in the Moon. And I know him well enough at this point from his writings and you know, all this documentation. I know that he would probably be really uncomfortable with that if I told him, Mr. Birchfield, you know, look at this tattoo of your work I have on my side. And I think
you really have?
I really do. I really do.
A tattoo, an actual tattoo.
An actual tattoo of an excerpt from one of the paintings, yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And well, it was actually very interesting because when the tattoo artist also loved Birchfield's work as well. And he mentioned how difficult it was to try and represent watercolor in permanent tattoo ink, you know?
Yes.
And so it's not in a bad place. I can show you before I take off. But I know that if I could tell Mr. Birchfield that I had a tattoo of one of his works, he would be totally flustered and would probably, like, walk away, you know, at certain points.
You show me that?
I can. I can show you that. I can show you in a moment. It's, like, on the side of my hip, and I'm wearing a slip, but it's totally in a safe place.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'd be interested.
Yeah. But it's very interesting knowing so much about a person that you've never had a real conversation with. And that's, I think, an interesting thing about being an archivist, you know, is that these people I am so close with, I don't have lived experiences with. So when you tell me things about what he was like, I'm just eating it up.
Good.
So, talk about his, you know, you mentioned a minute ago that he was a sad person.
Yes. I think that was primarily due to the fact that he was having a struggle financially. Because I remember when in the summer class, we went out to paint in the southern tier there. Well, let's see, around East Aurora and in through there. And before, we would gather at his house.
Mm-hmm.
Before we went out, and he had this old car, and he looked at it. I was standing, he was putting stuff in his trunk, and I remember him saying, I really need to get a new car, but I just can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very sad. This was all because of the financial problems.
And I think also, I think he was a good, from what I understand, he certainly had a lot of information to impart as a teacher, but I also know that teaching was very difficult for him.
Oh, yes. He didn't like it.
Yeah. I have this one photo of him possibly looking at a work by Sarah Perchownik, and it's a class. He's teaching a class, and I don't think he means to, but he's just making this face where he's just looking like this, and mm-hmm. he just looks so miserable. And
well, he didn't like to criticize.
Yeah. Mm. That's such a good reason.
It wasn't his way. He was a very gentle man.
Yes. And criticism is hard.
Mm-hmm.
Also helpful.
Yes, but if you don't like to do it, it's difficult.
Yeah. I think he was a very introverted person.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why what little bit I understand about his wife, about Mrs. Birchfield, about Bertha, she really seems to have been that more public-facing part of the couple.
I don't remember her at all, because she was stayed in the background.
Mm-hmm.
The only contact I had with the Birchfields was him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. From the sense I get from interviewing people who grew up with his daughters and art, she very much was the disciplinarian. You know, she was the one who also acted sort of like a gatekeeper to Mr. Birchfield and sort of ran things in the home and also kept people away from him so he could go off and explore the woods and find that inspiration. That little bit about the sunflowers, that's really significant. You mostly were a student of his, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that briefly.
Yeah, briefly, yes. What did you know? Did you know William West? Did you know Bill West?
No.
He was in the Art Institute of Buffalo as in the 40s. And he was a young African-American man who was the only African-American man in the Art Institute of Buffalo at that time.
Incidentally, I taught there.
Did you?
Yes.
What years did you teach there?
Oh, I don't remember. It was very brief.
Uh-huh.
It was a disappointing effort to create an art school. It just failed.
Mm-hmm. So I think it was a good attempt, but maybe didn't come to fruition.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Well, Birchfield taught there briefly as well. I mean, he was probably trying to make, you know, whatever money he could. But I got to interview Bill West a few years ago, who did also took classes with Birchfield. And after a class, they all went out to lunch together or something, or were going to a restaurant. And so they go into this restaurant, and, you know, Bill was a black man. And so they said they weren't going to seat him. And Mr. Birchfield said, well, then we're all leaving. And so they all left the restaurant together. And it's like these tiny little things give us so much insight into his character, which is why I'm kind of trying to draw your memories back to that time. It really tells us a lot. Oh, well, Walter, I think those are all of my questions.
Okay.
So I'm going to take another spin on this last question. So I asked you what advice you have for emerging artists. But if you could go back and talk to your 22-year-old self, what would you tell him about what to do with his career in the arts?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know?
That's an impossible thing to answer.
It is. Well, it certainly is a no more or less impossible than a wood nymph, you know. It's how do we use our imagination to look back and look forward and to the side.
It's just that I had this impulse to be an artist, and that's it.
You did it. Well, thank you so much for inviting me into your studio today to interview you and to talk about your career, which I think is, you know, that was a really good impulse. That was a really good door to open, becoming an artist, and I'm so grateful to have had this time here today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.